From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. President Biden is in Philadelphia today to promote his agenda and mark Amtrak's 50th anniversary.
Earlier on NBC's Today Show, the president was asked to defend that agenda and why he's proposing $6 trillion in spending and tax increases to pay for it when the economy is still recovering from the pandemic.
That's the reason why it's recovering, because we're investing. Look how rapidly it's recovered since we passed the last piece of legislation. And that legislation was $1.9 trillion. If we don't invest in this country, we're going to actually fall behind even further.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. Today we've got Eugene Daniels. He's White House correspondent for Politico and co-author of the Politico Playbook. And Olivia Nuzzi. She is Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. Great to have you both back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having me. Happy Friday, everybody.
Yeah, sure. So this week, we really did hear President Biden arguing that there are certain things only the government can do, such as invest $4 trillion on his infrastructure plans, plural. In his speech on Wednesday to Congress, he said the country's future hinges on it.
America's moving forward, but we can't stop now. We're in competition with China and other countries to win the 21st century. We're at a great inflection point in history.
Eugene, what is the president up against when he makes the argument, really as few modern Democrats in the White House ever have, that big government is good? It's the solution to our problems.
Well, first of all, he's against a Senate that barely has a majority and a House that also barely has a majority. So those are the first two things that he's up against. But he's also kind of up against this expanding what government can and should do, which is what they're trying to do. But he has to convince people that logistically the government can do that, right? He's talking about $6 trillion and these types of investment that are actually popular. If you look at the polling suggesting that people like the proposals that they have in these plans, not always the money, but that people should be doing things about care, about climate change, about roads and bridges, about broadband. But that is not easy to sell to people. You have to, he's doing kind of the most Biden trip ever, going to Pennsylvania for the Amtrak anniversary to sell this, because he has to convince people that we can do good things in your life. And honestly, after a year in this pandemic, three different checks that people were sent by the government, we've already kind of expanded how much influence the government has in people's pockets in everyday life in a way. And so I think they're banking on people, Republicans, independents, also agreeing that maybe the government should be doing a little more, but it's a steep hill to climb.
Olivia, has the scope of the agenda that President Biden has laid out so far in his first 100 days surprised many people in Washington, even his fellow Democrats? I mean, this almost sounds like a president who is different than the man who ran for president.
Well, you know, everything can be infrastructure is sort of the joke now that everything is included in this bill. The administration is sort of arguing a very progressive point. I think much more progressive than people who heard Biden campaign thought that he would bring in the White House. He sounds more, frankly, like Elizabeth Warren than the Joe Biden of the Democratic primary, for instance. But, you know, to Eugene's point, not only is it an uphill battle in terms of what they're facing logistically with the makeup of the Senate, the makeup of the House, but there's this sort of interesting point where a lot of people who I think were skeptical of big government or skeptical of people getting checks prior to the pandemic, a lot of Americans now understand the value of something like that because they got money from the government that helped them get through this pandemic. And even though these things are immensely popular, when you look at the polling about how people feel about infrastructure, how they feel about other parts of this this agenda, Biden is also still facing these trends of negative partisanship that have been worsening for the last few decades in American political life. So even if individual lawmakers understand that their constituents are very much in support of getting money to improve roads or to have broadband access, Washington is still sort of just held hostage by this negative partisanship that has really defined our politics since the Gingrich Revolution, and it's just gotten worse and worse over time.
Yeah, well, Olivia, you know, the people who might agree with your assessment that President Biden sounds a bit like Senator Warren could include the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. In fact, he called the president's speech on Tuesday a lengthy liberal daydream. And he said the American Families Plan the president put out this week will do things like micromanage child care choices and other terrible things. And he said he is clearly not on board if Democrats try to push these spending plans through on party line votes in this evenly divided Senate. Take a listen.
Our president will not secure a lasting legacy through go-it-alone radicalism. He won't get much done that way. It won't be good for the country. And whatever the Democrats do get done through partisan brute force will be fragile.
So, Olivia, kind of two points there. Number one, what can he actually do on a party line vote, mindful that everything can't pass through this special budget reconciliation process? And two, the fragility point, the argument from McConnell seems to be that Republicans will just undo whatever the president does the next time they're in power.
Right. I mean, that's sort of the difficulty. There's a lot that the president can get done with executive orders, for instance. His first week in office was kind of spent undoing through executive order a lot of things that the previous president did through executive order. And it sort of makes the case that no matter how much you can get done as president with your powers, if things are not enshrined in law, it really does start to look temporary. I think we're seeing this, on another point with climate, where the United States doesn't really have credibility despite what we understand President Biden's view of this stuff to be, because other countries are looking at us and saying, well, your system is such that no matter what any individual president gets done, unless there is actual legislation that is passed, it might just completely be undone the next administration that comes in. And I think, listening to McConnell there, it's almost like he embodies this negative partisanship that I was talking about, where he almost has a string that you pull and he says some typically Mitch McConnell line that he could say at any other point probably in this administration, where he is not going to get on board with anything that the Biden administration suggests. And he's going to use some alliterative phrase to paint Biden as this radical. But like Eugene said, these ideas that Biden is putting forth, that the administration is putting forth, are very popular. And I think at some point you kind of run into the difficulty with individual lawmakers where their constituents would like their lives to improve, would like the government at the federal level to do stuff to help them. And most people in their everyday life are not thinking in intensely partisan terms the way that lawmakers in Washington are.
Well, then, Eugene, I mean, how long will the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer wait before just forging ahead without Republicans?
I think they, first of all, to the first word of it being a laundry list, every one of those speeches is like this hour and a half long laundry list of conservative lips. So, like, that is just something that has been true since the beginning of time. But on that point, I think the Democrats right now are being pushed by Biden to try and do this in a bipartisan way. That is actually how, based on my reporting and sources that I've been speaking to, how he actually wants to do probably most of these bills. But what they continue to say, and they've kind of redefined bipartisanship to mean it's not just about Congress, right? So Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, everyone understands that if they reach a point, probably I would say, a month or so of back and forth between Republicans and Democrats on what is infrastructure or how much it should be, whether or not, there's two or three or four bills, how they're going to do this is really interesting. One of the aspects of this is that the infrastructure, the actual, roads, bridges, the old school way of thinking about it, it could be one bill, right? There's Coons, the Senator Coons from Delaware, talks about this a lot, having just one bill that they could go through and have it be bipartisan, actual bipartisanship. And the $600, I think it was, billion dollars that Republicans came back with kind of matches up with the $600-ish billion dollars in the Biden plan for roads, bridges. And so there seems like if they can get to one bill and then move the other stuff, the CARE force stuff, into a different bill, that might be a way that they're interested in doing it. But they're not going to wait much longer because they keep saying that. They keep promising people that Americans can't wait to be saved. So they have, not much time left.
And, you know, just to follow up on Eugene's point there.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Sure.
You know, Biden has always talked about wanting to work in a bipartisan way, almost at times sounding at odds with the reality of politics in Washington as he has experienced it for, you know, nearly half a century, especially during the Obama administration, where Republicans displayed just absolutely no desire to work across the aisle. And at a certain point, progressives, I mean, we already hear it now this early, progressives start to lose patience, and progressives do not want Biden to work so hard to work in a bipartisan fashion. And so I think the administration is in a position where the executive wants to work across the aisle, wants to talk to Republicans, wants to try to do things in a meaningful bipartisan way. The reality may be that he just politically can't do that. He needs to work without them.
Olivia Nuzzi is Washington correspondent for New York Magazine and Eugene Daniels, White House correspondent for Politico. Thanks again to you both.
Thanks so much. Have a good weekend.
You too.
For many single parents, the pandemic has been crushing. Single-parent households are reporting higher levels of stress and anxiety than other types of households, according to research from the University of Oregon. School and childcare once provided safety nets that now seem so much thinner. From member station WHYY, Avi Wolfman-Arendt tells us that story through the eyes of one mom who has spent the last year fighting to keep her family together and her kids in school.
I met Tiffany Zabera in the fall for a story about virtual learning. She was a 30-year-old single mom of four living in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, and she was struggling in that way where there's too much going on and not enough time to do it.
Sorry, I'm in my car.
This is from September.
No, I'm not driving. It's fine. It's just my kids are, you know, it's like a quiet place.
Tiffany's biggest worry back then was online school. She was working odd hours at a diner and trying to keep Cadence, her rambunctious first grader, focused on virtual classes.
She'll be like sitting in her chair, stomping her feet a little bit, but it's more of like a frustration. Like it's not anger. You can tell it's frustration.
But behind that computer screen, for Cadence and for so many other kids struggling to learn online, there's a deeper story. Learning from home. It's a notion that assumes there's a home to learn in.
What I thought was a low, you know, eventually got lower.
A year ago, Tiffany was making $55,000 managing a small pizza restaurant. She was sharing a house with her four daughters and a roommate who was helping her watch the kids. COVID changed everything, almost immediately. First, she lost her job.
They fired me because I couldn't devote the time and I couldn't, as they put it, keep up with my responsibilities because of how much it just became with the kids being home and on virtual.
In May, she says her landlord died from COVID-19. And then right after we spoke in September, her landlord's children decided to sell the house. Tiffany got a lower-paying job as a line cook at a diner. She found another house with roommates in the same school district. But within a week, she discovered that the roommate watching her one-year-old daughter during the day was drinking heavily.
I didn't know. I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't know what to do. I'd never been in that position before. I was afraid to ask for help.
Her two oldest children went to live with their father. She was short on money and out of options.
And then my two younger kids were with me in my car.
For about a month, they lived in her sedan, usually parking outside hotels at night. Tiffany felt like a failure. She'd grown up in foster care, and she didn't want to tell anyone about her homelessness because she feared her kids would be taken away. The home where her ex lived didn't have internet, and her two older daughters stopped going to school. Finally, a school truancy officer tracked Tiffany down.
She's like, the only reason you would lose your kids right now is if you don't get help.
The truancy officer steered Tiffany to a social services agency, which helped set her up in a hotel room. She also landed a union job on a construction road crew that pays $20 an hour. And on the day we spoke, in mid-March, Tiffany got the call she was waiting for. The agency had found a landlord who would rent her a house.
You know, the basis of my parenting has always been to try, you know, even if they don't have it as good as some other kids, you know, they know that they didn't have it that bad. But then with this year and everything that happened, you know, they were homeless. They were living in a car, you know. than me living in a hotel in a one room with five people. So those are the memories I wish that they didn't have.
Things are getting better, though. Her first grader returned to in-person classes in February.
She loves school. She's so excited about it. You know, she loves it. She calls it real school.
And recently, her daughter wrote a full sentence for the first time with proper punctuation.
It said, "I love you, Mommy. You're the best."
Tiffany says this year has given her new perspective. 12 months ago, she was living a stable life in a middle-class suburb. She knows how fast that can disappear. But she also knows that if she's willing to seek help, she can make it back.
And I said, I guess that's what keeps me going, because I know it will get better. I know it will get better because I'm going to make it get better no matter what I have to do.
It's going to get better. Tiffany says that a lot. It's sort of her mantra. And finally, after this brutal year, it feels true. For Here and Now, I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
Well, it is not getting better in India. Today, the first batch of masks, oxygen cylinders, and test kits from the United States arrived in that country as COVID rages out of control there. India has hit another daily record in cases, more than 386,000, and more than 3,500 people have died in just 24 hours. Anger over Prime Minister Narendra Modi's handling of the response is palpable. Joining us now is Femi Okay, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She helps us analyze culture and conversations on social media. Femi, welcome back.
Thank you, Peter.
I know you've been speaking with people on the front lines in India this week, and some are even taking to social media with pleas for help. What are doctors saying?
I just checked before we jumped online together, to see what the health minister of India was posting, because that gives you an idea of, you know, the mood in the country, or definitely the mood in the ruling party for the country. So I had a look at Dr. Harshvardhan's Twitter feed. Overall, the posts are very encouraging. He's telling Indians, how do you manage COVID safely at home? He's actually sharing best positions for getting more oxygen into your lungs with diagrams. So the health minister is trying to convey a sense of don't panic. But at the sharp end of India's second wave, doctors are struggling to find beds for patients and even oxygen for patients. Have a listen to Dr. Kama Kaka speaking to me earlier on Al Jazeera's The Stream.
To live from one oxygen cylinder to another oxygen cylinder, we can't just live like that. We can't live under so much of pressure. We can't live under so much of anger in public, in which when they're not getting beds, they're not getting ventilators, they're not getting oxygen. We can't live under that wrath of public. You have to do more. You have to do better.
So Delhi is one of the worst hit areas regarding India's second wave of COVID-19. Hospitals can't cope. We've seen pictures of people standing in line, begging for assistance online, begging for oxygen cylinders. Delhi's regional government even took that issue with a lack of oxygen to the High Court. And India's Solicitor General said, "Let's try and not be a crybaby," quoting the Solicitor General there.
Oh, wow.
Definitely an empathy gap, Peter.
Yeah. You know, we heard the doctor there refer to the government in India and how it's got to do better. You've told us a little bit about how the government has responded, but what else are you hearing from the government?
So while the doctors are asking for basics like beds and oxygen, I put this to Syed Zafar Islam. He is the spokesperson for India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, and this is what he told me.
It may have created some shortage for a couple of days, but I'm sure that going forward, all these issues are being addressed and all the regular supply in Delhi. This is primarily in Delhi, and there are some shortage in the neighboring state, but no situation is in control.
So reaction to this comment, some of reactions coming from within India: monster, you're murderers, and also some resignation from Rita Pawar, for instance. She posts that in spite of the disastrous situation that we are in, i.e. India, they are still confident, i.e. the BJP. They say that the lack of oxygen in Delhi was blown up by the media, Peter.
Oh, wow. Well, there's another reason the government is under scrutiny, and that is for asking Twitter to block some people from tweeting about this crisis. And in fact, Twitter did block at least a few dozen tweets, including some from prominent figures, one from a Reuters journalist who had taken pictures inside a packed hospital. Twitter said, look, we're just complying with local laws here. But this seems to be a problem for the government. What else have you seen?
So the whole reason that this is even possible in India right now to block social media or to censor social media is because in February there were new guidelines for social media companies and digital streaming sites. And what these guidelines included was an ability by authorities to say that some content, if they decide it is illegal, is illegal. So that is why Twitter was asked to take down some content. And earlier in the week, Facebook and Instagram had also been asked to take down content. For instance, a hashtag resign Modi, asking for the prime minister to resign. Facebook temporarily blocked that hashtag and then said, oops, that was a mistake, Peter.
Yeah. Yeah. Meanwhile, mutual aid efforts have been popping up on social media in India, as we saw in this country when the crisis was really bad in the early days. People need help. People want to help. What are you hearing online?
One influencer from India told me that Twitter is now a healthcare system. We used to tweet back and forward. We'd have political arguments. We'd tweet for fun. But now we're using it to get essential equipment to people. So you will follow, this is my grandma. She needs an oxygen cylinder. Where can I find one? And then people trying to get this oxygen cylinder to a grandma. One of the posts I saw just today, Javid from Bhopal turned his taxi into an ambulance and he's ferrying people to hospital for free. And amongst the deeply, deeply political conversation is a lot of citizen helping each other, saying, how can we save each other's lives? But at the same time saying to the government, why are you still holding political rallies? Why are these potential super spreader events still happening? And then also one journalist saying to me, who was from within India, covering the news on a digital platform, saying, we also have to look at ourselves. We're acting like we don't know that there's COVID-19 in the country. And we also have to social distance because we can see the result right now. Peter.
Femi Okay, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. This is an important story. We're going to keep an eye on it, of course, but it's great to see this through the lens of social media. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
In stressful times, you want to spend your time checking out not just what's best, but what's best for you. We know you care about what you watch, what you read, and what you listen to. NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast is with you 5 days a week to make sure that time is well spent. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
And if you've been to fill up your car at the gas station lately, you may have noticed it's costing more. The national average is $2.87 for a gallon of regular, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. And that's a stark difference from a year ago, when gas averaged less than $1.80. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, gas prices have been rising steadily for a few months now. So what's going on? Why are the prices going up?
Well, the main issue is simply that life is sort of returning back to normal. Restrictions from the pandemic are being eased. More people are getting vaccinated, and that means more people are commuting to work or driving for leisure, taking vacation, and that's really created a big upswing in demand. And really, not just for gasoline at the pump, but people are booking more flights now, too, and that jet fuel competes for the same crude oil that is refined in the gasoline. And on top of all this, Callum, OPEC is really keeping a lid on supplies globally. So that's helping to keep that price of crude oil pretty firm. And that translates back then into the gasoline market.
I see. So we can't just blame that blockage in the Suez Canal, though I'm sure that didn't help. But, you know, not every place is feeling this equally, Mike. I mean, California has the highest average in the country, $4 a gallon. Where else are we seeing big surges?
So prices are rising pretty much everywhere. Nationally, if you look at prices from AAA, gasoline is up almost 30% since the end of 2020 and up more than 60% since this time last year. Remember, that's when the lockdowns were at their most strict and many fewer people were driving. When it comes to California, they've hit $4 a gallon, which is very high. But that state tends to have higher prices in general, simply because it has tighter environmental regulations. And California and some other states also require what are called summer blends due to environmental regulation. And that type of gasoline is just simply more expensive than the winter blends, Colin.
So listen, I mean, we can complain about the prices getting higher, but people will really be griping if they can't get a gallon of gas. And yet we may be looking at a fuel shortage this summer, Mike, partly because we're reading that there's a shortage of qualified tanker truck drivers. What's going on there?
Right. So the National Tank Truck Drivers Association issued a report basically warning that there could be a shortage of drivers this summer. And these are tricky jobs to fill because you need a special license to drive a gas truck. A simple 18-wheeler license doesn't work. But I think it speaks to a bigger issue about how this return to sort of a normal post-pandemic life is creating a lot of mismatches in supply and demand in many other parts of the economy as well. For example, computer chip are in great shortage. Semiconductors used in everything from cars to computers to our phones. So there's a big upswing in prices there. And I think in this case, this shows that there is still sort of a mismatch in the labor market, that some jobs are having a hard time finding workers to fill them.
It's kind of a delicate balance, isn't it? On the one hand, the higher prices can be a sign of the economic recovery, but if it gets too high, then it can have some bad economic consequences as well, which I know you'll have your eye on. That's Mike Regan. He's a senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thanks as always for your time.
Thank you, Colin.
Thirty-five years ago this week, ABC News anchor Peter Jennings delivered this headline.
There has been a nuclear accident in the Soviet Union, and the Soviets have admitted that it happened. The Soviet version is this. One of the atomic reactors at the Chernobyl atomic power plant near the city of Kiev was damaged, and there is speculation in Moscow that people were injured and may have died.
In fact, at least 30 people did die in the initial explosion at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. Radioactive particles were released in a cloud that drifted over most of Europe, and the disaster is still felt today. Dr. Alla Shapiro was a first responder in Kiev at the time, and she joins us now via Skype. Dr. Shapiro, welcome. It's good to speak with you.
Thank you very much. Likewise.
So, April 26, 1986, you were a pediatrician at a hospital in Kiev that's not far from Chernobyl, where the nuclear meltdown happened. What do you remember about those first days of the crisis?
I remember that I learned about Chernobyl from my dad, who called me at 6 in the morning, and he told me that there is a nuclear explosion, and he is very concerned. But none of us didn't hear anything about Chernobyl officially for the first 13 days after the disaster.
And yet, children, I understand, were coming to your hospital in Kiev. They were getting bussed in for treatment from the disaster zone. What did you see?
Some of them had coughs and mainly anxiety and fear. So the psychological symptoms came first, but we were not aware what the radiation caused.
So were you even prepared at that point to treat the children for that kind of radiation exposure?
No, we were completely unprepared. We didn't have any training, neither in medical school nor in our residency. So everything was just our intuition and past experience that we tried to apply to what's going on.
So what did you do?
Many of the children just had this persistent cough, and we didn't know what is it. So some of us figure out, let's try oxygen, and we put children in tents that we made, maybe 8, 10 at the same time. And then we had oxygen tank that we put in the middle of the tent, and we pretend that we are playing with children not to scare them.
Meanwhile, what about your own family? Many thousands of people in the Soviet Union and actually all across Europe would eventually be diagnosed with cancer because of the fallout. What do you think your exposure to radiation was in your families?
Well, my family, luckily, especially my daughter, who was 3 years old at that time, we sent her to the safe location. But I was sent two or three times to the most contaminated area without any instructions and without any protective gear. So I know that I was exposed to radiation, but I have no idea what doses of radiation I received because we were not given the device that measures radiation. This was just the reality that we faced.
And you were diagnosed with cancer years later?
22, to be precise. I was diagnosed with colon cancer while living and working in the United States. And this is probably one of these late effects of radiation that affect people.
How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm doing well.
Good. Well, as you said, you moved to the United States and you actually worked with the FDA on developing countermeasures and medications for radiation exposure. So this has become a part of your life over the last 35 years. But do you think, considering your personal and professional experience, that there is really any way that we can prepare for a nuclear disaster?
Yeah, I think we can, and we have all the resources to get prepared. Physicians and even medical students should have some mandatory training how to recognize and at least think of the possibility of radiation injuries. If they don't have this awareness, they would never think about it. And if they don't think, they won't be able to diagnose and subsequently treat the disease.
Sometime later, Mikhail Gorbachev said the disaster was perhaps the real cause of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And for a long time, the silence and secrecy from Soviet officials was very much a part of this story. How do you think that made matters worse?
Well, not sharing information, downplaying disaster, telling lies. Also, government officials instead of scientists were providing the information. This really propelled the tragedy and made everything worse.
Alla Shapiro was a doctor in Kiev in 1986 when the Chernobyl nuclear reactor exploded. She has just published a new book. It's called Doctor on Call, Chernobyl Responder, Jewish Refugee, Radiation Expert. Dr. Shapiro, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pandemic boredom, a love of the environment, and a little encouragement from mom led a brother and sister in Pittsburgh to start an aluminum can recycling business. They offer contactless weekly front door service. If their neighbors have aluminum cans, these kids will recycle them. The Allegheny Front's Andy Cubis tagged along to catch the can crushers in action.
My name is Tegan Ellsworth, and I am a can crusher.
My name is Leo Ellsworth. My age is 7, and I'm part of the can crusher's business.
It's really cool to see it, like, squeeze up and just crunch because it's just super satisfying. You just pull on a lever, which then crushes the can, and then it goes into a bin below. We actually didn't always have our can crusher machines. We used to just crush them with our foot. It's not the most enjoyable process once you do like a million of them.
We're about to go on a pickup. Let's just go to the end of the block. There's about 15 people on our route. So this house had two bags of cans.
Very good.
I feel like when I didn't have this business, I was maybe, like, oblivious to the stuff around me. I was able to navigate a little bit around my neighborhood. I'm emptying the cans that we just picked up into a bin, which then, after our pickup, we crushed 9 bins in all. Notebook. So we have a logbook of when we do our drop-offs, how much money we make, and, oh yeah, and we say how many pounds we got. August 4th, $48.10.20. February 26th, $98.49. Definitely earned more than we expected to. So for any kid who wants to start a can crushing business, I would just say start off with your neighbors, and slowly it does spread because your neighbors tell their friends they drink stuff out of aluminum cans too.
I feel like I'm helping the earth because these cans could just be thrown away into the garbage. If you're recycling them, they actually get reused.
And just not to have litter everywhere.
Well, when they're all crushed, we have a problem. When we're bored, we don't have anything to do. Okay, got it.
Oh my goodness, Tegan and Leo Ellsworth in Pittsburgh. You know, they have collected more than 300 pounds of cans for recycling. Their revenue, so far, up to $130, matched by mom and dad, which Tegan says they're mostly saving for college, though they do sometimes get candy or snacks with their extra cash. As they should, by the way, these are aluminum titans. And they've got tips for kids who want to start their own can-crushing business at hereandnow.org. Fewer and fewer Americans are getting vaccinated every day in the United States. The number is down 22% from earlier in the month, which means that on the path to herd immunity, people like Pastor Sean Daniels are going to play an important role convincing people who are hesitant to get the vaccine. White evangelical Christians are especially reluctant. Almost half say they're not going to get it, according to a poll from February. Sean Daniels, pastor of the Friendship Missionary Baptist Church in Kaywood, Kentucky, joins us now. Pastor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Can you help us understand why there's so much reluctance among white evangelicals to get vaccinated against this disease?
There is always some type of skepticism in this area. Whenever there's anything new or anything different, you know, particularly in the Bible Belt region, a lot of folks will jump to conclusions, and they'll take the first thing that they hear, whether it's true or not, and they run with that. And that's where there's concern.
Well, is that reluctancy a matter of religion? In other words, you know, if it's God's will for me to get sick, so be it. Is it a skepticism over science? Is it about politics? What is it?
It's not really a political thing. It does come back to biblical matters. Because of some of the teachings about the end times and about what many times people refer to the mark of the beast. And that in and of itself is where a lot of people are having these fears because they've been taught that there's going to come a time in the end times, as they're told, that you're going to have to receive this mark, that it's going to be forced on you. And that's one of the things that puzzles me as a minister, that no one's forcing you to take this vaccine. But, you know, it's recommended, and it has nothing to do with what, you know, this teaching is all about.
Are you saying that people there are equating the vaccine with Satan? You say Mark of the Beast. That's what I think.
Right. Yeah. It's part of what's taught in the book of Revelations, and that's what it's referring to.
So when someone comes to you with that concern and says, Pastor, is this vaccine the mark of the beast? What do you say?
Well, I automatically shoot it down because It's not that. And according to my interpretation of the scripture, nowhere there talks about a vaccine. Nowhere there talks about it being something like that. And that's where the confusion comes in. And I took the vaccine early on as being a chaplain at our local hospital. It was offered to me. And anybody that comes to me personally, I will tell them that it's safe and it's something that, to me, that God has given our scientists and doctors the ability to create, and it's completely safe.
When someone asks you that question, is it coming from a place of real fear?
I believe some of it is. And a lot of my fellow pastors have actually preached over the last year during this entire pandemic about fear and how fear is not of God and that, you know, we don't need to give in to fear. And I agree with that. But then when it comes to this vaccine, this is something that a lot of individuals, Christians all over, prayed for a treatment and a vaccine. And I truly believe that our God provided and gave the knowledge to create these. But now you've got this issue with this reluctancy, and it's puzzling.
So the Biden administration and really public health officials are relying on people just like you, someone who is trusted in the community to help get good information out about the vaccine when people are skeptical or when they're fearful. But when people are also set in their ways, or if they're listening to misinformation and taking that in, how do you effectively steer them away from it?
What I do is I talk to them. I try to, first of all, calm them down and say, you know, listen, let's use common sense here. Let's use, and I refer to godly wisdom, because I believe that God gives us wisdom. He gives us direction and guidance on things like this. And we need to, you know, be faithful and trusting and understand that, you know, throughout the history of mankind, that there's been so many different advancements in medicine and research and all these things. And this is no different. And so I just try to calm them with some facts and then just tell them, you know, this is okay. As a leader, as a faith leader in this community, with all of my heart, this is okay.
Well, so do you get up and preach about this? You know, because if you did, that might make a difference.
You know, and I understand that, but that's one thing that I'm very cautious about, because I try to be careful about speaking about the vaccine behind the pulpit, just as I'm careful about talking about politics behind the pulpit. The last thing I want to do is cause any kind of division. However, if anybody comes to me personally, I'm absolutely going to give them my personal views and opinions on it, and which I have. And, you know, it may come to that someday. But right now, I'm just hoping and praying that people will just do this on their own and make these efforts. In any way that I can help, I'll do that.
Sean Daniels is pastor of the Friendship Missionary Baptist Church in Kaywood, Kentucky. Pastor Daniels, thank you very much for helping us understand this just a little bit better.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me today.
Here and Now, we are a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now.